welcome to another edition of Disrupt Ed, where we talk to the disruptors out there, those people who are helping to make sense of an entirely and ginormously disrupted world. And what do I mean by that? It's a 5G wired, workforce augmented, technology interconnected, globally interdependent, AI accelerated, pandemic interrupted world of work and learning out there. At the same time, today's guest is an extraordinary treat. You are really in for something today. I'm going to talk to you about my new friend, Dr. Mark Klein, who's going to talk to us about the aerial view. So here's what I want you to think about when you think about Disrupt Ed. We have Disrupt Ed, the upskilling and education edition, where we talk to educators about how disruption is happening in their world. We have Disrupt Ed, technology and advanced manufacturing, where disruption is happening there. This show falls under our third umbrella, and that's ordinary humans, extraordinary impact. And what I'm about to tell you is the gentleman you're going to listen to on this next series of episodes, and trust me, we're not going to be able to do this in one. We're going to probably do two or three episodes, and we're going to have him back. He just wrote a powerful book with the backdrop of a powerful career as a physician. Mark Klein is a physician who has written this book, and I'm going to hold it up because my copy, as you can see, is already dog-eared since I got it. It's Wisdom from the Aerial View. And so the topic for today is Disrupted. What does the aerial view help us to understand about this disrupted world? And so, Mark, first and foremost, thank you for patiently waiting for me to get through COVID so we could tape this show and get this show going. We've talked about it all summer. So excited to have you. Thank you for joining us. It's going to be a real treat to have you on here to explore some of the topics in this amazing book.
Well, Ron, thank you for inviting me. As you know, I'm super excited. You're a fantastically interesting and kind person, and I'm sure people who listen to you already know that. I've been very blessed to get to meet you and start to, you know, become friends with you. And yeah, I'm very excited about this book. And I guess we should just jump right in.
Yeah, so let's jump in. So I think where we jump in, you and I, is why in the space of our years, we're known as people who collect friends who don't know strangers. You and I both have that strongly in common, okay? And so the question I have to ask is, how did we, over the course of the last 3 months, come to have such a strong bond with each other? And I think a lot of it is explained in the aerial view. But I also want to harken back to just one other thing that I think is kismet, that I think it connects our story, and that is how we met in the first place. The person who ultimately is the poster child of collecting people is Larry Kirschbaum, former CEO of Time Warner Books. And we had him on the show earlier this year. And Larry is a mensch of an extraordinary caliber. He is one of the most special people I think I've ever met on the planet. And you guys serendipitously later in life met each other at a book signing or something. I can't remember exactly where. And you became friends. So I want to start with that story because the connection between Larry, you, and me is the one that's going to drive some of this story, I believe, because it's faded.
So there's a chapter in this book, Wisdom from the Aerial View, called Connections. Because these things that we, I'll give you an example. So you asked me how I met Larry. I met Larry through a mutual friend who so without names, I think I can tell you this. He and his wife were patients of mine. And, you know, a doctor has a tremendous opportunity if you take it. You know, to me, being a doctor is a privilege. It's an honor. When other doctors say to me, I got called by some patient 5 times this week and they're so annoying. I go, you got that completely wrong. You know, when somebody calls you as a doctor in the middle of the night or on a weekend, your first thought should be how honored you should be. Because somebody's trusting you with the most important thing in your life, their health or their, you know, family's health. I mean, that's like a gift. That is a gift from God, if you believe in God, but it's just a gift, okay? To be able to have that ability to make a difference in people's lives, that is a gift. That is the beauty of being a physician. Unfortunately, medicine's changing. We can get into that at some other point. But so anyway, they were patients and we became friends. And then this gentleman was friends with Larry, and we started talking, and we've just developed this relationship over the last, I don't know how many years, and now 5 years, 10 years, maybe more, probably 10 years. I don't know. I can't keep track, but it's something like that. You know, and I tell people all the time, and people watching or listening to this are going to, the first thing they're going to do is roll their eyes. I guarantee it as soon as I say this statement. When I say I care more about you than I care about me, that's the truth. And that's just when the people start rolling their eyes. Okay, who is this guy? Come on. That nobody feels that way. But yet, I do feel that way. That's the whole point. That's why we're here. That's the message, right? If you boil it down, is the joy in life comes from helping others, comes from making a difference in somebody else's life. So if I, you and I have a friendship, and in some way I impact you and you feel better about yourself, about your life, whatever, I win, right? Okay, mission accomplished. That's the point. So if people, I would tell people all the time, if you want to be happy, the first book I wrote was about happiness. This is my fourth book. The first book I wrote was about happiness. And I'll boil it down. Happiness is, in my view, proportional to two things. The relationships you develop in life, and we can talk about relationships at length because it's quite a broad subject, and the accomplishments you accrue in your life. What do you do, right? What do you have to show for yourself? It can be building a house, writing a book, learning how to play, you know, creating a piece of music, anything you do, baking a cake, creating a recipe, it doesn't matter. The act of accomplishment is where self-esteem is generated. Without self-esteem, you get nowhere. We've gotten this completely backwards now in our society. We think we can give somebody self-esteem like a cookie. You know, here, you're not feeling good? Here's some self-esteem. No, you have to earn it. Doesn't work otherwise. So anyway, so for me to be able to have an impact on another person's life, you know, there's a saying, to save one life is to save the world, right?
Right.
It's in my view, completely true. I didn't write it. I didn't invent it. I don't take any credit for it, but it's true, right? And so that's why I wrote this book. You know, as a doctor, I took care, believe it or not, 100,000 patients over the course of Amazing. 45 years. It's a lot of people. And I talked to every single one of them. Every one of my talks, some for a minute, some for an hour. You know, it depends on the situation. But I've met 100,000 people. There's a limited number of stories in the world, right? Human stories. It's a finite set, right? There's nothing new under the sun. As Ecclesiastes, you know, you can read in Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. So there's a limited set. When you talk to 100,000 people, you cover a lot of them, right? And so as a doctor, I tried to help each one as best I could, not just medically, but in terms of, I'll tell you a quick story. I had a patient one day, never forget this, about a 70-year-old woman, and I did a test on her. And I finished the test, and I said, you know, Mrs. Jones, everything's great. It's normal. And instead of a smile and, you know, joy, face was flat, affect was flat. I went, I don't know if you heard me. It's normal. Everything's great. Nothing. I said, something else is bothering you. She goes, no, it's nothing. I said, no, something's bothering you. You know, what else is bothering you? She said, well, it has nothing to do with my medical problem. I said, that's okay. We can talk about anything you want. You know, tell me what's bothering you. Well, you don't have time. I go, I do have time. I sat down on the edge of the, you know, couch there, the end of the bed in my office. And I just let her talk for a few minutes. And she unburdened herself about, I honestly don't remember what the issue was, but just that act of unburdening, right? That's when we finally got a smile out of her, right? Because it doesn't, if you want to make a difference in this world, you got to do it one person at a time. You got to be willing to listen, and you have to put yourself in a situation where you're not the most important person. You know, we live in a society now with selfies, right? It's exactly backwards.
Right.
Take that camera, turn it the other way. You want to be happy? A selfie will never make you happy. Turn the camera the other way. That's where the joy is. So I've been very blessed in my life to have that opportunity as a doctor. And I talk in the book about the fact that there's a chapter called What's My Job? And the truth is that everybody has the same opportunity. You just have to take advantage of it.
I love that perspective. But I want to go back to something about your practice as a doctor that's very revealing and very unique. And that is, you talk to a group of residents in one of the chapters who were sitting around when you were a patient. And you said, I want you guys to wait for a minute because I think you're missing the point. And the idea that you shared with them was they're not there to fix a medical issue. They're there to listen and to make your life better. And even by the small act of asking someone else, how are they doing? What do you want to talk about? You did that consistently as a doctor, but for many doctors, they don't feel that's possible. They don't feel like that's part of the regimen, or in today's healthcare infested world, they're under so much pressure to see so many patients and they limit their time. But it's interesting because after meeting you, I started reflecting on some of the medical care I've had over the years. And I was just recently with my doctor and I realized he does, I'd never struck me before, but he does exactly what you do. At the end of each visit, he says, how's everything else going? And I respect the fact that he has a lot of patients waiting and I'm not there to take a half hour to, burden him with my story of the day. But it has a powerful impact just being able to, as you said, unburden yourself or simply share what it is that's going on at a certain time. You know, I want to take you back, Mark, and I want to hear a little bit about your origin story so that we can properly frame how you sort of ascended into this aerial view of life, which I want you to then kind of expound upon. But let's start with your origin story, how you started out in medical school and how you became a doctor. And I think that's an interesting starting point for your journey and how we ended up here.
Well, it's a very, I don't want to take too much time in this, but it is an interesting story because it just illustrates how serendipitous life is in a certain way, but yet in retrospect, it really wasn't serendipitous at all. All these things are connected. So when I was a senior in college, my dad, who at that point was 59, developed cancer. And he developed a cancer of the head and neck. He was a cigar smoker. And, people say, well, cigars don't cause cancer. No, cigars cause cancer. They're dangerous. So I'm not here to preach to anybody what to do. But, I always tell people, you should at least know what your risks are. Do whatever you want, but you should have some information. Anyway, he developed head and neck cancer. I had applied to medical school. I had taken the MCATs and done very well, and I was quite confident I was going to get into medical school. And I applied to a bunch of places, and I wasn't getting the response that I anticipated. I'm thinking, this is weird. Long and short of it, I got on waiting list at like three places, but I didn't get in. And I was quite stunned by this. That's part of the story I'll get to in a second. So now my dad then has surgery, recovers, and had a short window when he was actually pretty good. It was actually the time I graduated, so he came to my college graduation. And then not long after that, he started to head south and didn't do very well. And I didn't get into medical school. Again, not sure why, but fine. I took a job in a hospital, a local hospital where I lived. And my dad was in and out of a different hospital about 20 minutes away. So that year, where I would have been in medical school, I worked as an orderly. An orderly is like now, they don't use the term anymore, but it's like a male medical assistant. So if you can think of the lowest rung in the hospital, that was me. Bedpans, baths, changing beds. I remember one of my closest friends said to me, he was working in the emergency room, and he said to me, call me the first day. He said, call me when you've cleaned up your first patient's bottom. And I said, I'm not doing that. I was 22 years old, 21, whatever. I said, I'm not doing that. I think I was 20, whatever. And he said, okay, just call me in the emergency room the first time you do it. And of course, 20 minutes later, I called him, right? So it was a very humbling experience. I was cleaning bedpans, cleaning patients, cleaning up, making beds, you name it. And then at the end of the day, my dad, in those days, cancer patients were often in the hospital. It wasn't now where they keep people out of the hospital as much as possible. They were always in the hospital. So I leave my hospital and go to his hospital and sit with him till visiting hours are over, and then I will go home. This went on for many, many months. And then, unfortunately, my dad passed away. Eventually, I got into medical school. And it turns out the reason I didn't get into medical school because I was in college during the Vietnam War protests, and I was, I was an active, my voice was well heard. I mean, I can't understand how people destroy things or, in those days, we just marched and sang songs and nobody did anything, harmful or destructive. I don't understand that. But anyway, and it turns out the head of the committee who was writing the recommendations for medical school was a very pro-Nixon, anti-protester guy. He wrote in my recommendation that I was not quite a rabble-rouser, but whatever. Okay, so, when I found out about that after I got into medical school, a few years later when I got to see my records, I was stunned. And then I realized, wait a minute, if that hadn't happened, I would have gone right to medical school. I wouldn't have had that experience working as an orderly in a hospital, which taught me so much about life. And I wouldn't have had the time to spend with my dad during those last months. So look, you know, I still get choked up when I think about this. I'm thinking, so that was a gift. That guy who I hated, I mean, that professor who wrote me that mediocre recommendation, I was so mad at him, right? And then I realized years later, oh my God, he did me a favor. And that's how the world works, right? It's a cascade of events. You cannot evaluate any single event by itself. Every choice you make, and I spend a lot of time in the book, as you know, talking about choices. But when we make a choice, we release a bubble. Imagine your choice like a bubble being released into the universe, into the world. As soon as that bubble's out, everybody else's choices, everybody else's bubbles are banging into it. There is no way to know where that bubble's going to end up. It's impossible. So the point is that when you make a choice, you initiate a cascade of events, and then the other choices out there are banging into yours. There's no way to know what's going to happen. So we spend so much time in our lives worrying about making the right choice. Is this the right choice? Is this the right job? Is this the right person? Should I marry this person? All these choices, even simpler choices, you know, should I live here? Should I live there? Should I buy this car? Should I buy that? Whatever it is, right? A million choices. And we think one of these is the right choice. Which one is it? How do I know which is the right choice? And the answer is there's no such thing as a right choice. There's no such thing as a best choice. You make what you think is the best choice based on the available information, and then you let that bubble go, and you have no idea what's going to happen. So think how unburdening that is, right? To be able to know that when you make a choice, you don't have to worry whether it was the right choice or the best choice. It's impossible to know. Do the best you can, let it go. Well, how liberating. It's right. Such a liberating concept.
So, Mark, you talk about the distinction between the aerial view and the street view. And the street view, if I could summarize it in my own understanding of it, is life as we know it, things bumping up against each other, the day-to-day. And the day-to-day imposes upon us a certain assumptions about how we live. I have to do this in order to do that. I need to do this to make this happen. I need to compete here to get this, and it may or may not be at the expense of someone else. So that's the day-to-day. And then you impose on this everyday world order something entirely different, the aerial view. So I think it'd be useful now to kind of connect the dots and to share how that aerial view encompasses our everyday street life, you know, life on the street level, and what it means in terms of our lives and our existence.
Sure. So the street view is exactly what you said. It's everything in life. You know, we eat in the street view, we drink in the street view, we grew up in the street view, we fight, we argue, we play, we love. Everything that happens is in the street view, right? That's life. And if that was the only way, if that was the only real manifestation of how to view the world, then a lot of the stuff we have, all the contentiousness, the arguments, even the wars, everything, it kind of makes sense, right? You know, people argue about this, that, whatever. It would make a little more sense. But it's not the only view. There is another view. And here's an analogy that I use in my book. And I hope, Ron, that this was helpful to you when you read the book to explain the aerial view, is that imagine reading a book. Now, you're a book guy, right? Mm-hmm. You spent most of your career in books, right? Right. So you read a book, and let's say we're reading a fiction book, and there's a protagonist, there's a main character, and the main character goes through all these things. And that main character is present, you know, in that book on every page, and people come into his story, maybe his family, wife, kids, friends, blah, blah, coworkers, you know, outsiders, strangers, things happen to the protagonist as he or she moves along through the story, right? And we're watching this, and then something happens, and we go, and we see the protagonist is in great danger. And we know the protagonist is going to make it to the end of the book, because we just know that, right? But right now, on page 174, it looks pretty bad for the protagonist. Something bad's happened or about to happen, whatever. The protagonist has no idea what's going to happen to him or her, whether this is going to be the end of his or her life or whatever. But we know, we're only on page 173, there's 400 pages in the book, right? We are outside the book. We are above and away from the book. So we can evaluate the protagonist and his or her life from afar as the observer. We're not emotionally connected. I mean, we might get emotionally connected as a reader always does, but basically it's not going to affect our lives. You know, it's not right. We're away from it. Protagonist has no idea what's about to happen. They're stuck on that page. That protagonist cannot jump off the page and, you know, become the observer. So that's the point. To elevate to the aerial view is to become the disinterested, separated observer. Now, it's not just to evaluate other characters, it's to evaluate what's happening in your life or in the world in general. So I always say when you elevate to the aerial view and become the disinterested observer, you no longer have a horse in the race. You no longer care who wins. There's no winning or losing. Right. It's just observing, right? So here's what's cool, what's really cool about it. You know, from the beginning of the book, I throw in a little physics, a little Einstein relativity and quantum physics, all in a couple of pages. It's not very, obviously, in a couple of pages, you can't describe these things. But the point is, the world is not what you think. That's a really important point for people to get to. Time is not what you think. When I was a kid, and I still to this day cannot explain it. I must have been 12 or 13, I don't remember. And I had this sudden, epiphany might be strong, but this sudden feeling that there was something about time that didn't make sense. And all of a sudden I sensed that time was a thing, an entity, not moment to moment, but this whole block of something, and that it all existed contemporaneously. It was a very strange feeling for a 12 or 13 year old kid to have, right? And I would have this other thought, like I would say to myself periodically, what is the furthest point in your life? This would pop into my head. What does that mean? Right now, obviously, but no, this thought would persist that it meant something else. So here's this young kid, you know, trying to figure out, why do I think all of time exists? And what's this whole idea about what's the furthest point in my life? But I just knew it. I just felt it. I didn't know it. Fast forward a number of years and I read about it, relativity, and I go, oh my God. Einstein, in his theory of special relativity in 1905, famously taught us that time, in fact, is not what we think, that all time does exist contemporaneously. He famously said past, present, and future. For we believing physicists, past, present, and future are just a stubborn illusion, right? And most physicists who would embrace that because he's proven it. It's this fact. This is science. It's physics. It's not my opinion. Just the way it is. So when you get to the aerial view, you're not just looking down at what's happening. All of a sudden, all of time becomes visible to you. All moments are like these individual little pieces. I would say you can move them around like pieces on a game board. You realize that the past, even though it looks like cause and effect, it doesn't work that way. It's just very hard to wrap your head around. But the only reason I bring it up is to understand that our world is different than we think it is. It's not the linear, you know, timeline that we think. Right. It's not just cause and effect. The future can affect the past. These are crazy ideas. And the only reason I even bring them up is for people to understand. Once you realize the world is not what you think, then it liberates you to look at everything differently. When you elevate to the aerial view, now you see all opinions, not to say that all opinions are equal or all positions are equal, but you just see them all, right? You just start watching them, right? All time is laid out before you. And all of a sudden, all the things you thought were so important just diminish in importance. So I'll give you an example. So I have friends, who are very strong liberals and have said to me many times, I will never live in a red state. And I look at that and I go, I understand your political feelings and you're welcome to them. And I have no comment on those. You're entitled to whatever you want to believe. I'm not even going to tell you what I think. It doesn't matter, right? You're entitled to it. But when you say you don't want to live in a red state, it means you're stuck in the street view. You have not gotten to the point where you appreciate all points of view and the significance of all choices and how we're all interconnected and all these things you think are so important are not. So I'll give you an example. We have an election coming up in a month and you might have an opinion about who would be the best choice. None of that. Let's put it this way. Under whom would the country fare better? And I'm not going to ask you what your opinion is on that, but you probably have one and most people have one and they're pretty sure that this person is great and the other person is going to be a disaster. And what I would say to all of you is that you have no idea. This is a good time to let humility filter into you. The way the world works is you can have no idea. It's not that you can't see the future. It's that it is impossible to know these things. The way the world works, but this interaction of all choices banging into each other, you have no idea what's going to happen. So you can say, I think, you know, Ms. Harris would be better for the country and Trump would be a disaster or vice versa. Right. You're welcome to that opinion. As long as you then say to yourself, but I could be wrong. Because it's impossible to know. So when somebody, I always say, when people feel like they're on the moral high ground, it's a really good time to let the bell should go off in their head and go,
nothing is ever right. Well, basically what you have to say at that point, as I came to appreciate it, is nothing's ever 100%. And as certain as you may be, you may find out in 5 minutes that you were completely wrong about something. So time doesn't really exist in the aerial view, does it? Or it exists as this continuum where things that happened in the present are happening in the past, they're happening constantly, and they're happening in other planes of existence, right? And so...
So here's another very, I'm sorry, here's a very another comforting thought. I find this extremely comforting, at least for me. I hope it is for you, having read the book, and people who are listening and watching. So the way time really works, the analogy I like to use is a jukebox. Imagine a giant jukebox. Everybody knows what a jukebox is. And you have all these records. And we play one record at a time. And you put your money in, next record, right? So imagine a jukebox, and each record represents a moment of time in order, okay, of how they occurred, like history. From the moment of the Big Bang to whenever this universe ends. So it's a pretty big jukebox, right? The right way to think about time is not one record playing at a time and then going back. It's imagine every record, which each record representing a moment of time, all records playing simultaneously and forever. So all the records are playing. It's a big cacophony of noise. And so what that means is that the way we look at time, for instance, you and I are having this conversation right now. We call this the present. Well, the present is already passed because now we're on to the next present, and the next present, and the next present. And then these moments slide back into what we call the past. So the conversation we had 5 minutes ago is now in the past. And we assume that is irretrievable, grayed out, can't get to it, right? And the future is this blank slate. No. All those records are playing simultaneously, which means the conversation we had 10 minutes ago is still going on. Now, it seems like we've moved on because, in this, yes, we're on a different record right now. But the discussion we had 5 minutes ago is still happening, which means every birthday you have ever had is still happening. Every moment you spent with a loved one is still happening. People who we've lost in our lives, we're still with them. So my dad, right, who I lost when I was 21 years old, you know, it was hard. I mean, I'm not the only person who's lost a parent, and people lost parents when they're a lot younger than that. I'm not a hero. I'm just saying that's the way it is. It was hard for me to lose my dad at that young age. But I realize now that I'm still having a catch with my dad when I was six years old.
He's still going ice skating together. In the aerial view, he's still right there, front and center. I think this is not just the aerial view, Mark. It's true. I have so many more questions for you. I think this is a good moment to break. For those of you who've been listening, we've been talking to Dr. Mark Klein about the aerial view and what a fascinating journey it helps to frame for each of us in this very disrupted life that brings a lot of anxiety with it. So welcome back to an episode 2 where we continue this discussion. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.